This group never wants to listen, they want to talk with each other. That's great. Good morning again. My name's Bernie Meyer, and we're dealing with the Liberation of Jonah, subtitled Our Own Liberation, subtitled Trying to Get at Some Understanding of Why, and this is my own thing, so many people in this country are supporting the Iraq War, when it appeared before the war that there wasn't much support, and now that the war is over, the hype about celebrating its end and our victory. So I'd like to deal with the war from the perspective of understanding why individuals, why society supports it. And I know I'm going to venture out a lot of my own thinking. And I know that there are a lot of people of goodwill and maybe much more knowledge than I have who supported the war. And there's everything I say won't apply to everybody 100%. I think it applies to everybody 10% to 100%. But you know, there's a lot of things I want to say, a lot of hard things. Part of the process we've been doing of reflecting on the Bible story and trying to understand what the people of history and the Bible and Christ went through and what the teachings are is this: we are, we act, and we reflect. And this is comes out of, it's a, one of the slogans of the ELCA's Congregational Social Ministry Program. And I think what's happening right now is we're members of the United States country. We acted in the terms of the war, and we're reflecting. At least I am reflecting, and I started reflecting right when the war started. What's going on here? You know, it was such a new phenomena. Especially what struck me was the amount of support for it. And so what is going on? So I started delving into the war. And I'd like to share this with you. If you would like to get into the discussion about what happened over there and a lot of analysis of the governmental action and so forth, the reasons and so forth, I think that might be better at a later time. I'd be glad to be part of that if some people wanted to talk about it later in the morning or this afternoon. But I'd like to propose some other things today. And it takes courage, I think, to look into some of the things that I'm going to propose. Mary Nielsen had workshops last week on the 12 steps, and I went to one on the fifth step, which is to look at the wrongs we have done to others, and then with ourselves and another person to share those wrongs. You know, as a way to draw out our guilt and anxiety and to resolve it and let it go, because you can't carry guilt, you shouldn't carry guilt through with. You gotta let guilt go. I mean, mea culpa, God forgive me, thanks for the forgiveness, that's grace, and let it go. And that's what the fifth step's about. But she said it takes courage for people to do the fifth step, because it means looking at yourself in very intimate ways, and it means sharing it with another person, which is difficult to do for almost everybody. So I think what I'm dealing with here is going to take some courage, although not necessarily in this room. Maybe some courage will have to happen here, but for us to, as individuals, when we go back home and with our congregations and our families, it may take some courage to live and deal with some of these things. And I'm sure many of you are with me or in some place facing these things courageously already, so it's, you know, maybe not sharing anything new with you. One of the things I did was go back to a book I read 20-some years ago, Eric Fromm on the Art of Loving. Eric Fromm is a psychoanalyst, philosopher, and so forth, who does a lot of writing. And I had written him early in my days of the peace movement and trying to be a young, relevant person. And he pretty much spelled out that maturity comes through self-love and loving others and so forth. But now I read it with new eyes. And I'm going to jump around, but I'm going to go right to his experience on love as a way of being whole as a person. And what he describes love as having is certain characteristic: care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. And it's in the area of care and responsibility that he gets into the Jonah experience, which I'll throw out to you as our text for the day, the book of Jonah. Before going into that, he says, love is the active concern for the life and growth of that which we love. It's the active concern for the life and growth of that which we love. And then he goes to show how Jonah was not a loving person, and God challenged Jonah to be a loving person. God has told Jonah to go to Nineveh to warn its inhabitants that they will be punished unless they mend their evil ways. Jonah runs away from his mission because he is afraid that the people of Nineveh will repent and that God will forgive them. He is a man with a strong sense of order and law, but without love. However, in his attempt to escape, he finds himself in the belly of a whale, symbolizing the state of isolation and imprisonment which his lack of love and solidarity has brought upon him. The whale becomes a symbol of his isolation and lack of solidarity which love would give. God saves him, and Jonah goes to Nineveh. He preaches to the inhabitants as God had told him, and the very thing he was afraid of happens. The men of Nineveh repent their sins and mend their ways, and God forgives them and decides not to destroy the city. Jonah is intensely angry and disappointed. He wanted justice to be done and not mercy. At last he finds some comfort in the shade of a tree which God has made to grow for him to protect him from the sun. But when God makes the tree wilt, Jonah is depressed and angrily complains to God. God answers, "Thou hast had pity on the gourd for the which thou hast not labored, neither madest it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should I not spare Nineveh, that great city, wherein are more than 60,000 people that cannot discern between their right hand and their left hand, and also much cattle?" God's answer to Jonah is to be understood symbolically. God explains to Jonah that the essence of love is to labor for something and to make something grow, that love and labor are inseparable. One loves that for which one labors, and one labors for that for which one, that which one loves. Care and concern imply another aspect of love, and that is responsibility. Today, responsibility is often meant to denote duty, something imposed from without upon one. But responsibility, in its true sense, is an entirely voluntary act. It is my response to the needs expressed or unexpressed of another human being. To be responsible means to be able and ready to respond. Jonah did not feel responsible to the inhabitants of Nineveh. He, like Canaan, could ask, "Am I my brother's keeper?" The loving person responds. The life of his brother is not his brother's business alone, but his own. He feels responsible for his fellow men. Fromm wrote, what, in the 50s, in this book, and this was very sexist. Anyway, it's a little aside. As he feels responsible for himself. This responsibility in the case of the mother and her infant refers mainly to the care of the physical needs. In the love between adults, it refers mainly to the psychic needs of the other person. And, you know, Fromm goes into this whole section of the love of a mother and child and how that is expressed, and getting to the love between adults, which is based on responsibility and so forth. So this is the biblical text for today, is the experience of Jonah. And because of time, we won't read the book of Jonah. I assume you've read it and are familiar with it. And of course, Fromm, I think, does a fairly good job of summarizing it. But what he's trying to get at is love. And in the meaning of love, as a way of maturity and being. And he's trying to get at to say that love comes from within. In my belief, in Christian belief, we contact God within and express it outside. God is working within us as individuals and as a community and so forth. But I'd like to go back to some of his starting points. Fromm is dealing with the whole question of our separateness as individuals, our own sense of being persons, and how our goal is how to be fully human and yet to be included with others. So I'm going to hit at this a little bit to give more context. The awareness of human separation without reunion by love is the source of shame. It is at the same time the source of guilt and anxiety. So being separated means as human beings we feel shame, we feel worthlessness, we feel guilt and anxiety. Men of all ages and cultures, man of all ages, is confronted with the solution of one and the same question. The question of how to overcome separateness, how to achieve union, how to transcend one's own individual life and find at-one-ment. We don't want to be alone. We want to be part of life and society. And so that's the starting point of this whole section on love. And then he goes into several different ways historically that this has happened, and he summarizes it on page 18. The unity achieved in productive work is not interpersonal. This one way that unity has been tried to achieve is by productive work. The unity achieved in orgiastic fusion is transitory. Some societies had rituals that were very orgiastic and sexual to achieve unity, and it led to an emotional psychic high, and boy, we're all together. He's saying that's transitory. The unity achieved by conformity is only pseudo-unity, everybody working together. So there's three different historical approaches he had described earlier that we try to overcome this separateness. Hence, they are only partial answers to the problem of existence. The full answer lies in the achievement of interpersonal union, of fusion with another person in love. So unity through love, you know, for others is what Fromm is trying to get at. But as we'll see here, it depends on becoming integral with ourselves to start with. True love can only be by having a great self-love. Page 13, I'm putting this in the Iraq war sense again, of deal with the democratic society and how we choose in a democratic society to support a very life-destroying thing. And he throws some light on this for me. In spite of this difference, the democratic societies show an overwhelming degree of conformity. So despite the fact that we're a democratic society and each of us has a choice to vote one way or another, there's nonetheless a tremendous amount of conformity. The reason lies in the fact that there has to be an answer to the question of union. We all, despite Limited Democratic Society, want to be part of everything. We don't want to be separate. And if there's no other or better way, then the union of herd conformity becomes the predominant one. So despite the fact we're democratic, we want to be part. And herd conformity is a way. One can only understand the power of the fear to be different. The power of the fear to be different. I've always wondered why business people were so conformity, you know, oriented. The fear to be only a few steps away from the herd. If one understands the depth of the need not to be separated. So, you know, the fear, we don't want to be separated. That's why we have the fear. Sometimes this fear of conformity is rationalized as fear of practical dangers, which could threaten the nonconformist. But actually, people want to conform to a much higher degree than they are forced to conform, at least in the Western democracies. So, again, we're struggling with this underlying reality of separateness, and we choose. And so right now, we're the Iraq war has been, in some ways, compared to a football game. You know, the television hype and all you know, the flag waving, and you know, it's really falls in line with our. So, you know, why do we do this? We want to be together. And then on page 20, he talks about mature love. In contrast to symbiotic union, mature love is union under the condition of persevering or preserving, pardon me, one's integrity, one's individuality. Love is an active power in man, a power which breaks through the walls which separate man from his fellow men, which unites him with others. Love makes him overcome the sense of isolation and separateness, yet it permits him to be himself, to retain his integrity. In love, the paradox occurs that two beings become one and yet remain two. For me, love in this situation means being in touch with my own sense of value, my own sense of existence, and I get primarily my orientation through struggling with the gospel and in life. So in the Iran war, my separateness comes from my own sense of integrity. My union becomes an effort to reach out in love to others, be they in agreement or disagreement with me. But I try to maintain my own integrity, and I think that's again Jonah being called by God to, you know, learn to love the people of Nineveh, even though he thinks they should be punished. Go out and love them anyway, Jonah, and challenge them. I'd like to go to a little aside here. What we tried to cover the other day, some of you may remember, is contemplation as a way of liberation out of the Beatitudes. And a point I was trying to make and didn't get across too well, I don't think. A man sitting quiet and contemplating with no purpose or aim except that of experiencing himself and his oneness with the world is considered to be passive in our society because he is doing nothing. In reality, this attitude of concentrated meditation is the highest activity there is, an activity of the soul, which is possible only under the condition of inner freedom and independence. One concept of activity, the modern one, refers to the use of energy for the achievement of external aims. The other concept of activity refers to the use of man's inherent powers, regardless of whether any external change is brought about. So he's talking about our penchant for activity in society. But what we consider passive contemplation, Fromm considers a very active thing, a very worthwhile thing. And I would submit to probably say that it's only by getting in touch with ourselves through prayer, meditation, that we can appreciate our integrity, our individuality, our, you know, who we are in God, in order to be able to fully love. So it's a little aside, but it's the essence of the matter too. Therefore, love is an activity, not a passive affect. It is a standing in and not a falling for. In the most general way, the active character of love can be described by stating that love is primarily giving and not receiving. So, that's the first part of what I'd like to present. Do you have something? Okay. Well, I'd like to present is this little meditation and commentary on Jonah and Jonah's call. And like we all are taken back at times when challenges come, and we all go in the whale and belly, and God has to help us through the struggle, and then we have to reach out like Jonah did to go talk to those people in Nineveh to be converted, to repent, a very threatening thing to do. And sometimes God is able to forgive like he did to people in Nineveh. And so, anyway, it's the loving action that we take in those situations. It comes from going within and then going out. The next thing I'd like to do is get a little different slant on this, a little more practical application, but I think it comes from the same basic idea that Fromm is getting at. And what I'm using as a source here is John Bradshaw's book on the family. Some of you may have read this or one of Bradshaw's books. Some of you may have seen Bradshaw on TV, on PBS, dealing with the family. I never saw him, but I read the book and talked to people about it. And again, I'm trying to get at the question of how we can support decisions of others like we did in the Iraq War. And here the question is, how could Hitler happen? Germany had been a citadel of Christianity, the birthplace of Protestant Reformation. Germany was a philosophical, theological, and artistic giant among the nations of the world. How was it possible for all this to happen? How could Hitler be possible? Many answers to this question have been offered. None of them is satisfactory. Nevertheless, it is essential that we try to find an answer. For in the end, the Nazi era came at the end of the Nazi era came a new development of nuclear weapons with their capacity for the annihilation of the human race. How could Hitler happen? Certainly, part of the answer lies in politics and economics. It has to do with self-interest, greed, the haves and the have-nots. Part of the answer is sociological, having to do with special interest groups and the laws that govern people and groups. It has to do with the shared focus and shared denials that group loyalty demands. In part is psychological, having to do with families and the rules that govern the family structure. And that's the part that Bradshaw deals with in this book. The family is the place where persons are socialized. The rules governing the prototypical German family were almost a pure caricature of the poisonous pedagogy. Indeed, obedience, rigidity, orderliness, denial of feelings, taken to the extreme, led to the black miracle of Nazism. Erik Erikson voiced this powerfully in an article on the legend of Hitler's youth. He writes, "It is our task to recognize that the black miracle of Nazism was only the German version, superbly planned and superbly bungled, of a universal contemporary potential. The trend persists. Hitler's ghost is counting on it. The potential for this to happen again resides in the ever-present existence of poisonous pedagogy." Previously in this book, he describes the poisonous pedagogy as the rules that we were raised on over the last 150 or so years, and our kids are being raised on, which creates abandoned and shamed individuals, people unable to be free emotionally. Obedience and corporal punishment are still highly valued as the crown of parental discipline. Our television evangelists preached this often. In the 20s, it was argued that the Weimar Republic could not succeed because of the totalitarian structure of the German family. The authoritarianism, which gave the father such unequal rights over the mother and children, did not provide a climate in which democracy could be learned. Well, that raises the question and answers it to some degree of why so many of us are choosing to support the war, and are we the question I'm trying to grope with is, are we supporting it because that's what we truly believe, or because somebody out there has said this is the way to do it, and we want to be part of that winning team in society. Bradshaw deals with the family as a system. We're not just a group of individuals, but it's a system, and each part of the system is interdependent. And he deals with the idea of codependency a lot in here. But I'm trying to get basically at the point of freedom and the loss of freedom. I know I'm going to be skipping through this a lot, and I'm not going to do justice to this, but I hope you get the basic idea. The blocking of choice is what I call the disabled will. Blocking of choice. We cannot choose fully what you're doing. He calls it a disabled will. Once our will is disabled, we lose our freedom. Since shame binds all emotions, everyone in a dysfunctional family has their freedom greatly impaired. This is perhaps the greatest casualty of dysfunctional families. So the whole issue of shame in a family system, how does shame come about, what is it, and what are its consequences is what he's dealing with here. And you can call Fromm's statement earlier on about shame being the greatest source of guilt and anxiety, and the whole question of trying to deal with our separateness and so forth. So it's the core issue of our identity. The will needs the eyes of perception, judgment, imagination, and reasoning. The will, to be free, needs these tools. Without this source, it will be blinded. The mind cannot use its perception, judgment, reasoning, imagination when it is under the impact of heavy emotion. Overwrought with emotion, your mind is blocked. The particular emotion, which is a form of energy, has to be discharged before the mind can function effectively. When emotion is repressed, it forms a frozen block which chronically mars the effective use of reasoning. Anyone who has had an outbreak of temper or been depressed has experienced how difficult it is to think under the power of these emotions. And I'm going to read a section here on kids. As we learn, the incoming data is given meaning and stored in our memory banks. When new information comes in, it is compared to what is already known and either stored accordingly or becomes a new bit of stored information in a memory. When an experience is not resolved, it cannot be stored appropriately. And that's the point he's struggling with. We get a lot of experience as a kid, we store it as we receive it, and it becomes twisted, and therefore we're getting at the blocked, frozen willpower. Unresolved experience has to do with emotional discharge and meaning. The mind cannot function when biased by emotion. Our emotions are powers which give us readouts on our basic needs and move us to action. When a child is abandoned through neglect, abuse, or enmeshment, one of three transactions usually takes place. One, mythologies are created to explain abandonment. The child is given reasons, number two, for abandonment which makes no real sense and shames the child. Or three, the child is told he cannot express the feelings he has about the abandonment, usually fear, or hurt, sadness, anger. In fact, all three transactions are aimed at repressing. You're not you. Then he goes on to explain these three things. First of all, he explains mythologies. Mythologies are meanings given to events or actions in order to distract from what is actually happening. So it's a dysfunctional mythology here, given a different meaning for what is really going on. For example, in a family dysfunction by work addiction, the work addict father, who is actually emotionally abandoning his children, is explained away by the enabling wife mother by saying, "Your father works so much because he loves you and wants you to have nice things." So boom, the father is emotionally abandoning his kids, and the myth given to it is he loves you so much. And of course, kids have no choice by who they are but to believe that myth. And so they suppress their own feelings and so forth because this myth says the father loves them. Even though emotionally, where's my dad? What's going on here? The second case, the poisonous pedagogy, has all kinds of reasons for abuse. For example, "I'm doing this cause I love you," or "this hurts me more than you." In the third case, the emotionally blocked parents cannot handle their children's emotions. Mother's own sadness stimulated by the child's crying, this is distressful, so mom forbids the child to cry. And that gets into the whole thing of, you know, emotional abuse or whatever other kind of abuse takes place, goes from one generation to another, unless you learn a new way in the process. And this mother has her own emotional needs, and the kids crying raises them, and it prevents the mother from maturely as an adult parent helping the kid work through her own, or the child's own, emotional stuff. In every case, the distress experienced cannot be stored because the emotions cannot be discharged. What occurs is a frozen pattern of blocked energy, which builds as life goes on. This frozen pattern clogs one's creative intelligence. It forms a trigger which functions like the on button of a tape recorder. Whenever any new or similar experience happens, the old recording starts to play. Here we see the force and power of behavioral conditioning. Like Pavlov's dog, whenever stimulation occurs, the response automatically takes place. This is the basis for reactions, or reenactments. The pest so contaminates the intelligence that new and recreative responses are not possible. Blocked emotions take over the reasoning and judgment of intelligence, and the effect is cumulative. It is like a snowball rolling down, getting larger and larger. Once our kids are shamed, we act out of shame and create more shame. Once a false self is created to cover the secret private self, each new shaming event solidifies this false self even more. With each new abuse that precipitates anger and sadness, the old triggers are turned on and the old frozen record starts to play. This is the basis of what we refer to as overreactions. Over the course of a number of years of repressing one's emotions, one's intelligence is greatly contaminated and diminished. The frozen patterns become chronic patterns. It is as if the on button becomes stuck and plays all the time. That is what I call internalized shame. And he has diagrams to show this. Then it becomes a lifelong struggle to discover this fact and to deal with it. So if we have a society in which millions of us, and Bradshaw estimates that 60 million people have been abused in their lifetime, therefore are suffering from some level of shaming and in some level of internalized willpower, we are a vastly dysfunctional society, and have a lot of liberating to go through. And it goes back to, in the terms of codependency, the most common family illness is codependence. You have one member of the family, maybe with some dysfunction, alcoholism, workaholism, compulsion, any number of things. All the family is part of that, and it becomes a family system. This is something that's really become appreciated in recent years. And this is what Bradshaw is drawing out in this particular chapter, is the codependent family and its consequences, and how society is an expression of this. The utter atrocities of Nazism have shown us clearly what the inherent potential of destruction in the patterning rules we have been using for the last 150 years. These rules are non-democratic. They are based on inequality of power and unequal rights. In essence, beginning with the power, the parents are the answer, the kids are minority citizens in the family situation. They promote the use and ownership of some people by others and teach the denial and repression of emotional vitality and spontaneity. They glorify obedience, orderliness, logic, rationality, power, and male supremacy. They are frequently anti-life. These rules are carried by family systems, by our schools and churches, and our government. They are the core belief of the modern consensus reality. Society itself becomes the ultimate dysfunctional family system. As a system, it follows the principles of general system theory. Society or culture has a life of its own, distinct from the lives of those within it. Society or culture is a closed system. Like individual families, we have examined the society as a closed system, dictates the roles, sex roles, and so forth, and behaviors the individual can choose from. The society as a closed system calls forth certain characteristic behaviors and processes in the individuals who make it up. Our current society encourages codependence and in many ways views it as normal. A good example of our cultural numbing and codependence is sexual addiction and sexual abuse. A large amount of level one sexual addiction is considered normal. This includes multiple affairs, pornography, and compulsive masturbation. Most of us are so emotionally dead that it takes horror stories, sexual abuse, to get outraged. Emotions move us to action. Without emotions, we are zombie-like. As we redefine child abuse, especially sexual abuse, we realize that it has been going on for centuries. Perhaps 60 million of our people have been sexually abused. This abuse results from sexually addicted families. There are disastrous consequences to everyone, even in so-called mild sexual abuse. Sexual shaming is a major factor in this. Sexual shaming occurs regularly in our families, churches, and schools. So I think you get a sense of where Bradshaw is at and where he is going. And this is pretty much where I'm at right now in regarding the Iraq War. I feel like I'm in the whale of the belly right now, reanalyzing, belly of the whale, reexamining who I am at this time, trying to understand what is going on at a deeper level, reflecting, on the gospel and on these kinds of things, and where do I go from here? So I don't know if this, I'm asking, does this relate to some of your perceptions on the matter? Is this appear consistent to, with your experience and so forth. And today I got out everything I wanted to say by just going through it. Got 15 or so minutes. We can talk.
I think some of, you know, I agree with a lot of what you're saying as far as the reasons for the conformity, the reasons for the celebration, the reasons for not questioning. I think it goes beyond that in a couple of other things. One of them is that I think as a nation, we're feeling some of the same isolation that you're describing to individuals within the society. And mm-hmm. that is with Europe becoming Europe and Soviet Union doing its thing and so forth. And the United States historically has always sought for justification by building large alliances agreed upon by an exterior principle or a series of principles mm-hmm. of law. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what Bush did and what our leaders did there, was an attempt to build sort of an international consensus and get an international conformity going mm-hmm. that maybe isn't, you know, isn't possible. And certainly I don't think it's justified by the circumstances that exist over there, but that's beside the point. I think that's what some of what we're trying to do.
And it's trying to become, overcome our separateness.
Yeah, and until we come to a conscious awareness of our ability to be separate, and at the same time caring and concerned for others. And, you know, we do all sorts of things to try to connect us to other nations, as a nation. And not all those connections are bad, but if they're going to become a conformity that we're connecting for no other purpose than connecting, they're going to destroy. I mean, that's a very scary thing to me, because that's the same thing we're doing on the individual level very often. When something comes along, a fad or an emotional upheaval of the nation towards one solution or another. We saw in Minnesota, not terribly long ago, we had a series of very violent crimes. And the immediate answer was, let's go out and intensify all the penalties, and that's going to solve the problem. You know, and we look for quick, simple solutions that we can agree upon in a mass group. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're, I think you start from the individual, you go to the groups you belong to, mm-hmm. do the same yeah. thing, then the groups that they belong, the groups belong to, and if you take it up all the way to the nation itself. So I think we can change it without being aware of it.
So what I hear you saying is we're all, you know, as a nation, we're separate from other nations,
sure.
and we want to be part of. But are we doing it in a mature adult way, or are we doing it in an emotional,
immature
way?
And if, you know, if we can, we'll force other people to make
partners. Yeah.
We'll use our leverages and so
right.
forth, and we have many.
Right.
And many times.
I think we're using many too, but
yes,
yeah.
Yes, I think we do use many.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it certainly applies.
Mentality, the conformity, and realize as the war was being talked about and the actions were proceeding, how I myself got caught up in that. And my friend John and I were driving to Portland one day, and I was sort of discussing my struggles with, was the war right or not, you know. And he just said, no, it's wrong, war is wrong. You know, well, that jolted me back to what my really feelings are. To hear some other voice say that was very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm. So you discussed with him the,
yeah.
the meaning of that of war in general, or this particular war?
This particular war.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I guess to be everybody yeah. saying the same thing, we're all afraid to say something different.
Yeah.
When somebody finally says something different, then, oh yeah.
Yeah. The appeal to your own sense of right and wrong. And you were convinced, not that because he said it, but because
that's my true feelings.
You got in touch with your true feelings. And that to me is the way, what we're trying to get is, what are our true feelings? And draw them out, yeah.
The discussion on the war was not necessarily on right or wrong war, it was good and evil. And I think there was an attempt for us to, the emotion in us from little on to fight Saddam Hussein rather than whether war is right or wrong. And it was a matter of good and evil. And who could be against evil? I mean, who could say, oh, no, we shouldn't take care of evil?
I don't think anybody thought Saddam should continue in power. I mean,
no.
I don't think anybody anywhere felt.
But it also came out of me, like, well, yeah, he's evil. He's got to do something.
Right.
And if that was the whole purpose of this war.
Yeah.
We were conditioned very much.
We were conditioned by that, and then the rightness or wrongness issue was submerged underneath there, and even got to the point later on. The just war theory, which is a traditional Christian theory, you know, was it used? This is a just war, and there's been a lot of reaction to that. That was a misuse of the just war theory. But it started out with the vilification of Saddam and went on to.
And what's really confusing then to me, and I suspect to others, is that now we seem to support him being power. Better than the Shiites and others. It's just very confusing because he was the personification of evil, and now we sort of support that he should be in his
country. Yeah. It is, isn't it? Yeah. What aims were achieved in that war? And, you know, were the government's real aims achieved or not?
Yes.
Didn't it start out with oil? The very beginning.
I think oil is one of the key issues, but I think there's other key issues, and here we're getting into the what actually happened, but yeah.
And then it was switched over to the big powerful Mimi picking on Kuwait.
Oh, I thought it was just the opposite. Didn't it start with freeing Kuwait, and then...
I thought it was the oil that became...
Can anybody help us with that?
I think the both are going on at the same time. With the same announcement, I think if you read the same denouncement, as my memory calls me, as I recall best, there were two paragraphs to the speech that was delivered saying, we've got to free Kuwait because we can't have one nation extinguishing another at this time. We've got to have international law. And the second paragraph was, we also have to protect the American way of life and not have all our oil fall in the hands of the enemy, and I think that I don't think the two were ever inseparable. Then it became that we've got to save the Democratic Republic of Kuwait. I don't know where that ever came from. that was the most interesting twist to the
process.
But I think we have to say our objectives. What we want is a weak Arab Middle East. And therefore access to the oil. So if you want to talk about our objectives being accomplished, yes, those were the actual objectives of our government, whatever. We're not particularly interested, I'm afraid, in a democratic Kuwait. Or we could have done something when we were in there to help the Kuwaiti democratic movement restructure Kuwait, which we absolutely did not. We actually, in some of our behavior, put them down. In other words, we took them and moved them, as we did in some of the places after the Second World War, out of the positions of power they were in, so that the Emir's forces could come in and take over. You know, which is exactly what we did, for example, in Vietnam after the Second World War. The French could not get back to Vietnam, and the Dutch could not get back to Indonesia without our fleets. We were the only people who could take them back. And so we took them back and said that they had the right to take over again. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that, but we do it because, you know, we don't look at our own heritage, we don't look at our own principles, we don't look at our own value. We want to be loved by certain people. And you know, you always want to be loved by the ones you consider to be your friends or the ones you admire.
Yeah, and that's for sure.
Those are the people we make the movements to get the allocates of and the applause of. And I think that if we looked at ourselves a little bit better and closer as to what we we actually need to do in terms of what comes from within, our own self-love, our love of what we want to be. We do different things. That's hard.
Especially with the gospel, the Sermon on the Mount is an epitome of our belief as Christian people.
Well, you know, that's fine, but even taking it another stage, take it from the Christian people to our own declaration, just take our Declaration of Independence as a nation.
Yeah, what that's
we don't have to say that everybody here is Christian.
Yeah.
We can say that just take our own principles as a nation when we're looking at our national.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always reluctant to take something like foreign policy and make it into a arm of the Christian church. I'd rather keep some of those things a little separate.
You know, as an institutional sense, I totally agree. As a person that's trying to live the gospel values, it's, you know, you're always trying to operate in society. And, yeah. In this war, you know, it was very interesting that before the war started, I think the official leaders of the church institution were against the war and pretty much maintained that throughout. But
I thought that it seemed to me that the church and the churches were silent. That was my perception anyway. Once the bombing started, it was then not proper for us as individuals or through our institutions to talk about the rightness or the wrongness of it.
I think I can agree with that. I was thinking before the war, the church, and I can remember just a few church leaders after the war started still raising questions. Like
it was your love of your country was suspect if you wanted to even talk about it. And I was distressed that it was considered not proper to discuss the rightness or the wrongness of war. And I was disappointed with the church, that the church wasn't at least encouraging discussion.
Do you have,
if not to take a position one way or the other, but to encourage discussion, because discussion was considered wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very distressing, and particularly very distressing that our nation reacted that way. I find it inconsistent with the principles of our Declaration of Independence, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That was supposed to be one of the cornerstones that makes the United States of America different from the rest of the community of nations, is that we're not afraid to discuss these matters. If you wanted to discuss the rightness or wrongness of war, or even particularly of this war, you were considered to not love your country.
It's almost like a curtain went down the night the war started. The day before, the Congress was having a lively debate and almost went against having a war. And then once that curtain went down, everybody became of one mind.
Let's do it right.
Hmm?
If we're going to do it, let's do it right, and let's just...
Right.
You know,
let's stand behind it. Yeah. That was amazing.
I didn't hear that.
You
didn't? I attended three different churches.
Really?
One of them in our very, very conservative suburb of Eden Prairie.
Uh-huh.
And I heard in every church that I attended some challenge of the war.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't maybe as forceful as I would have liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what our leaders had.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid I've gotten to the point where I don't pay too much attention to them. But that's what I heard in the church.
Yeah.
Just that I attended.
Yeah. So there's a different experience than you had.
Would you think there was some sense of guilt that the people who were really ardently supporting the war had? So if there was an emotional overreaction, a blocking of reason, as you're referring to, that foreclosed any more debate, that guilt had to do with, one, waging war anyway, and two, the Vietnam guilt had been carried over.
I think some of those things were in play. I don't know how much.
Well, it's pretty difficult too when a pastor's in front of a congregation that has its sons over there to say this is wrong.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult issue for a person to handle. But my experience was too, it was addressed from our pulpit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
very definitely wrong.
I was surprised the country could be so behind it after there had been so much awareness of the Vietnam situation. TV shows.
And polls said 90% of the people supported the war after it started. Is that
probably
what you're...
Probably kind of for the support of the...
Yeah.
I don't run into these people that the polls are talking about. And it's not just people I associate with. I meet people in airports and all kinds of places, and I don't find the overwhelming support.
Are you challenging the polls?
I'm probably say one thing in public then... For example, I was on an airplane right when all of the hoopla about thank you troops and you know, you did a great job and we love you and we're all, I suppose from the media we would think that everybody is just enthusiastically behind the military personnel. Yet I was on an airplane traveling from in California, and there were four or five military people on our plane that were obviously on their way home. And not one single person, and you know, 90% of the people supposedly on this plane were highly, you know, very supportive. And not one person did I see come up and slap somebody on the back or shake the hand of one of those military personnel and say, yeah, great. I didn't see any of that in the human interaction. I just saw it in the polls.
Hmm.
So I don't know if there's some public behavior that's different from
what you experienced. Yeah.
I was on a plane where they announced at the end of the flight that this person was returning home who got applause. So from the group, as a group entity, they were affirmed. But I don't, announced, I didn't know what happened on Monday.
Right. Well, I'm glad to see the troops home too. And I was very anti-war during the Vietnam War. And, I never spit on anybody coming home, but I know some of my fellow peacemakers did, and I think that's been propagandized and blown out of proportion, but I don't want to be part of that in any case. But I experienced a plane ride, and there was an old World War II film on, you know. Rah-rah type thing. And I think there's some hope, and that's what I'm trying to distinguish here. There is hope. You know, there are people who are keeping their heads throughout all this, and you know, we were kind of manipulated, we were very manipulated by the government and the media, and it was such a hard hit, it continued to be. So that's real negative, but there's the hope is that there are people who are alive and can see it. But what I was trying to get at through this and my experiences is that in preventing future wars and so forth, what am I caught up in here? And my perception and teaching is one out of five boys are sexually abused and therefore experiencing some degree or other this blocking, and how many of those are going to be cured? And one out of three girls are sexually abused in our society. That's a hell of a lot of abuse to overcome. And what does that say about our future in living democratically and so forth? So I'm seeing hope for things. There's a lot coming out of the woodwork. We're not hiding this abuse as much as we were, and that's hopeful and so forth. Maybe we'll cure it, but this is a real vital struggle that we're into, I think, in this country and in this world.
I think one of the saddest things that came out of it was in release time, which is a religious education thing in our school system. One of the third graders, they were talking about what are we going to do about these things in the world. So, and the response was, well, we'll just kick butt, which is a quote of our country.
And that's the attitude.
Isn't only our president, but all of our attitudes.
It kick butt on the football field and kick butt in Iraq, yeah.
That's what was personally saddening to me is that I've been active in the anti-war activities for over 20 years, and I thought that we've made an awful lot of progress. And then this has taught me that we haven't come very far at all. You know, where the attitudes are just, they I'm not respectable to talk about these things anymore, to debate them, and I thought that our culture had advanced somewhat in that regard, and the attitude, you know, well, we're going to solve our world problems by kicking butt.
One thing you have to remember is how that issue was co-opted. The third speech was, we are going to use the Iraqi experience as a way of healing the divisions that occurred in Vietnam.